Welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast. This month, in association with exerciseprescriber.com, and this is session 69. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another session of the Physio Matters podcast. This month, we've got a real treat for you as we speak to Elaine Miller, better known as Gussie Grips. She is all about comedy, teaching, and spreading messages that are important far and wide to the masses. Something that our little podcast attempts to do on a monthly basis, and she does far better than us with much more hilarity. So she will take you through lots of different things to do with wee and poop and a little bit of sex, and all making Jack really nicely embarrassed all the way through. So we'll get to that in a minute. I hope that you have all so far signed up for your big Ars tickets in October. We're getting closer to that date now, and you really need to get a shift on to get one of those tickets. You're going to miss out on the clinical content as well as all the policy stuff we've got going on around the Manifesto for Reform. Don't forget, if you don't live in the UK and traveling's a little bit more of a challenge for you, you can get virtual tickets at a 20% discount. Just use the code virtual early with a capital V and a capital E in the box at the end, and that will sort you out with a 20% discount. If you just can't be bothered to travel, or you want to save the petrol and the environment, then you can still sign up for a virtual ticket and sit in the comfort of your own living room and watch us. The whole conference will be streamed live, so sort your ticket in that fashion. Obviously, it'd be far better to come to the conference, because if you do, you can even come to the big party in the middle and probably see Jack cry on stage as he did last year. So who would want to miss that? Anyway, enough from me. I'll let you crack on and listen to Elaine Miller and learn absolutely loads, and get back to us with any feedback as per usual. I will see you at the end of the show.
I'm here today with Elaine Miller, possibly best known by her alias as Gussie Grips, from the internet and from this interesting blend of physiotherapy and comedy. Now, yesterday on Five Live, today on Physio Matters podcast, of course, she's stepping up today from yesterday, but certainly someone who's in the media and doing the good work of trying to get good messages out there amongst areas of information and misinformation that can be a bit ropey sometimes. And so we've just been having a chat off mic, and we'll visit some of those themes as we go. But today, the most part, we want to talk a little bit about continence and the way in which MSK Physio could need to know more about it, but also what they should and shouldn't do, thresholds for referral, etc. So we're going to get into the weeds on that. Before I go too far into the detail of the clinical topic we're going to talk about, I want to invite Elaine to introduce herself and tell a little bit about the background, because I've already touched on it being a bit unusual compared to most. I don't think we've had a physio come comedian on. And so definitely want to speak to that first. So welcome, Elaine.
Thanks for having me on. It is a kind of odd skill mix, isn't it? Comedy was a hobby that I had. After I'd had kids, I was quietly losing my mind because, yeah, it's just a bit all-consuming. And a bunch of us were turning 40 in a couple of years, so we had a bucket list thing. And I said that I would do stand-up, and thoroughly enjoyed it because it got me out of the house. And when you do comedy, they give you a microphone, so everybody has to pay attention to you and they don't interrupt, which was something that was lacking in my home life, so I really quite enjoy it. And I did a 5-minute spot about somebody wetting themselves on the doorstep, which was a story a patient had told me, and I had a permission to turn it into a comedy sketch. She was from Glasgow, so she was very funny, telling me about this horrendous situation that she'd been in. And after I came off stage, 4 women said to me as well. Now, they didn't know it was my job, and they were just responding to, like, solidarity sister. None of them had gone and spoken to their GP. So I thought, maybe you can use humour to access the subclinical women, the ones that if we can get hold of them now, then perhaps they'll not land up in the ridiculous state that patients are in by the time they come to clinic, because there's really good evidence that that is a lengthy process. for stress incontinence, it's an average of 7 years before somebody comes to clinic. So I would much, much prefer that people got good, accessible, evidence-based information, you know, at school. And then perhaps we could prevent a lot of these problems, because that's what the evidence is. So I wrote the Fringe show called Gusset Grippers in a Fit of Temper. And it was quite funny because the comedian community were like, yeah, no, you can't do that because you need to be going for 10 years before you do a solo show, and that's ridiculous. And I was like, well, it's my job. And you have a script at work. Like, you know, you see the same sort of conditions. So the basis of what you say is repeating to different people, because that's, you know, how we work. It's perfectly valid. You've got your information you want to impart. You do it in a more or less scripted way. And the show did okay. That's not true. The show did great. The average Fringe audience is 4. And on a weekend, I had 120 people in the room.
I'm glad you corrected yourself, because I was going to say, I did a bit of research into this and have known of that show being a real landmark intro. Very rare that a debut show would do as well as yours did. So I'm glad you didn't say it went okay.
Yeah, that's self-deprecating, isn't it?
A bit.
I'd like to think that it's because I'm really, really funny, but actually the reality is women are desperate for this information and they would come to a Fringe show. So it did fine, and it landed up last year. The run sold out and it got 5 stars. So I'm back this year, and what I'd really like to do is to sort of develop it into a way that becomes just part of the fabric of sex ed and of postnatal care, just the basic information that we want people to be aware of, that this is common, this is normal, this is neither, you need to come to clinic, and it's just basic patient education. So yeah, it's a bit of a carry on, really.
And what's the balance now in terms of your working week or working month? I know we're in the midst of the Fringe at the moment, and therefore I hugely appreciate the fact that you've taken your time out at the moment to chat to us. But also, just, I know that this might not be a typical balance, but if we're to go to a more typical time of year, what would your week look like?
I need to get some structure. I have taken a sabbatical from clinic at the moment because you can't prepare a Fringe show and do the run and work at the same time and stay sane. That's not possible. And I'm writing a book, so I need to meet the deadline for that. So I think I'm going to stay off clinic until later on in the year and try and get those deadlines met. Long term, I think if I had 2 days a week clinic and then 2 days a week doing all of this stuff, because it seems to work in that if you can get the commercial companies to engage in the evidence-based and stop promoting things that aren't factual, then you can reach more people. But the commercial companies have got a lot of money, which physios don't have those resources. If you work in the NHS, there is no budget. But the thing that we do have is we can access a market that's very difficult to reach in the case of continence. So that's how I was able to do the Fringe and take a sabbatical, because the Fringe is really expensive. Mm. The average cost of putting on a show with the big venues that I'm in now is 10 grand. That's hugely expensive. So I just polished my brass neck and said to commercial companies that had products that were good, that had products that had evidence-based or are on prescription, you know, I need 10 grand. Are you interested in sponsoring it? But everybody that comes through the show is a potential customer as well. So I've covered my costs, which is a huge relief, because my husband's like, so the thing that pays you money, you're not going to do anymore. That's right, darling. Yes, it's all for the greatest good. I will go back, but not yet. And he does not compute. So we should maybe set up
a partner's sort of help group. So my wife can speak to your husband about silly crackpot ideas that don't pay, that distract from the things that do pay. It would be quite a fun network.
Yeah. And he would really appreciate that. There'd be a lot of tutting.
Oh yeah, too right, absolutely. No, sorry, go on.
Yes, I think that we the fact is that, you know, the economy has changed, the funding for the NHS has changed, there's budget cuts all over the place, and yet we have skills that are commercially useful for external companies, and also we have evidence that we can save money. There's that data from the Falls project that the CSP did, yeah, that for every pound they spent on physio for within the context of falls prevention and rehab, they saved £3. Mm. Well, there must be data like that for every field of physio. We just don't have it at our fingertips. And unless you can prove those sorts of numbers, then you can't demand more money from the system. Mm. So I think being a bit more strategic in the sort of thinking, or not even strategic, like I don't have the education to be able to pull that data, but I know people who do. So I want to be able to get better at capitalising on that, because once you've got resources, if I've got financial resources, I can pay somebody to make infograms, I can pay somebody to do the social media and put the stuff that I know is effective and I know works because there's multiple Cochrane reviews behind it, and because there's, you know, I've got anecdata from people that have come through the show, but I don't have hardcore evidence. And in order to do that, you need money to research it. So we did try and look them. I did some work for Galway University, who've got a big public health department there that is the basis of Public Health Ireland. And we put in an application for funding to see whether you can use humour as a health promotion tool. Because if the data is that only about 25% of women ever seek help for their leaking, if you did an intervention, you know, a show or a workshop or something that's, you know, irreverent in tone, if more than 25% of them go on to seek help within 6 weeks or 6 months, you can see that it's effective. But the project was brilliant. I was really, really, academics are very clever. Not a really, really solid proposal. But the funding body turned it down because they didn't think that comedy would appeal to everybody. I was really annoyed because, like, well, of course comedy isn't going to appeal to everybody.
What does?
Doing it at the moment doesn't work.
Exactly, yeah.
If it did work, we wouldn't have all of these women being pishy. So why don't we try something else? So yeah, we'll see. I'll find some other way of doing it, but it is a bit frustrating. And I know it's not expensive, like in terms of budget. If I had, you know, £20,000, I could run that project. And £20,000 to big commercial companies like pad manufacturers is nothing.
No, exactly.
So
no, it's a great angle, and certainly one that I think we'll probably double back to in terms of strategy. You didn't like using that word, but the sort of how we can better unify that message and sort of channel some of the energy that is and should be behind the consistency of evidence that is continuing to emerge for this intervention. I think about some of the noise in my field of MSK for interventions or styles or flavours of practice that certainly don't have the evidence-based clout that the continence world does, having once again in prep for this read again into just the strength of that evidence base. I'm super jealous. You know, I wish I had that for anterior knee pain or for back pain. It's huge.
Yeah, so there's such a huge, it's just, you can't argue with it. Physio works for this stuff. There's multiple Cochrane reviews. There's gold standard evidence all over the world. Massive RCTs that have been done by physios in the UK. Like there's people in the UK that are real global leaders in this field and doing amazing things, and yet we're not teaching our undergrads this stuff. Mm. So it's the one field of physio that's got, you know, solid gold standard evidence. Why are we allowing new students to leave as qualified professionals without a single clue about what a pelvic floor is and what it does, when there's not a field that this information won't impact on? I'll get very frustrated about that. So.
It could count and balance this crisis of confidence we're experiencing to some extent. Like the more in the know a graduate is of the evidence base or lack of, the paucity of evidence that sometimes exists within some conditions or some things that were always a given that physio was the thing that we should solve, then a good news story such as that, and the falls example that you've used before, or community-based functional rehab of how it can really change life outcomes and things like that, they're the good news stories that need to offset the fact that, oh, we're not as good for helping sciatica as we once thought. I mean, it's just my last podcast, so that's why I mentioned that. We want to try and make sure that we give them that angle. Otherwise, they end up being a bit dejected nihilists that we're sending out into the world, because they're now... they can read the systematic reviews that might disappoint them, but there's certainly, like you say, there's ones like that that could be really heartening news. So yeah, that's definitely an angle we need to explore.
And can we say that we're experts in anatomy and function if we ignore a significant part of the human system? That I find it bonkers. And I know that the undergrad courses are absolutely jam-packed and it is a challenge to get all the information in place as it is, but I've done some work for a couple of universities and gone in and done like a two-hour lecture. Mm. And if we need more continence specialists, because NHS England's 10-year plan is that every postnatal woman will have a physio assessment, there's only 800 registered members. So unless we're going to be able to knit them, where are they going to come from? We need to tell undergrads this is a field that you can go into, and it's a field with great job security because there's not a lack of business.
Sure, no, that's a great point. And then also something I know we will come to is then upskilling an existing workforce to try and understand where those appropriate thresholds are, and hopefully we can inspire them in this chat and beyond. So one of the things I wanted to move us to, really, to get the ball rolling on the specifics of the clinical topic of incontinence today, is the prevalence. I wonder if you could, we've kind of touched on it, but I wonder if you could maybe throw some numbers to it as well, if you can, on the prevalence of continence issues and the associated conditions and predisposing factors surrounding it. What's the typical profile?
So the official stats are that about 1 in 3 women wet themselves, about 1 in 9 men wet themselves, and somewhere between 1 in 10 and 1 in 20 people have problems with bowel control. So it's incredibly common. There's good solid evidence that shows that pelvic floor exercises will help the majority of people. So somebody should be able to self-diagnose and self-manage with decent information that is accessible and available and that they can understand, which is a challenge in being able to put across, because the average reading age in the UK is 11. If you've got a reading age of 11, you can read the sun. But when it comes to health education, the average reading age is 8. So the challenge is putting the information across in a way that people can really grasp it and understand. That's not to say the public are stupid. It's that health education is difficult.
Yeah.
If they can come to clinic, then physio has, there's a good paper that Australia used to sort of as a platform to start looking at prevention. So it was a big study that they did, and they found that 84% of stress incontinence was cured within 6 physio sessions, which is massive. Mm-hmm. So what Australia did from that was fund a huge public body that addresses continence, and they have TV adverts and they have a lot of outreach. They have people in vans going out into remote outback areas to go and educate them about pelvic health. My issue with the stats, though, this is why I get into trouble, because I'm too gobby and I say, well, what about? and ask questions that are awkward. When you look at the data...
You remember who you're talking to. I feel you pain.
I'm amongst friends here. When you actually look at the data, now I'm not an academic, so looking at research papers from, you know, I need to... I have opinions. I'm not good analysing data, but what I noticed was almost all of the information was accrued from participants gleaned from clinic. Now we know that only about 25% of women ever seek help, and when you look at the breakdown of who comes to clinic, they're almost exclusively urban white middle class women. Now urban white middle class women are amongst my closest friends. It's not that they're not deserving of input, but it does flag up that we know very little about the rest of the population. And so these figures that we have are shocking. It's appalling that 1 in 3 women are wetting themselves. But I know, because I am female, if I go to the school gate and start asking any school gate, any bunch of mums, here's my new trampoline, would you like a go? They all just look at you like you were mad. Of course they're not going to go in the trampoline. So actually I think the prevalence is much, much higher because we're not asking the question in a way that is skillful enough, because we're taking all of our data from the people that are the unusual ones who are help seeking, because they have the freedom in their life to be able to afford the transport to come to clinic, afford the time to come to clinic. And these things are barriers for the majority of the people that we need to contact. Mm. So I argue quite strongly that we don't have a clue how big this issue is, but I would hazard a guess that most women over the age of 40 know that they don't belong in a trampoline, and if they've had kids, they would do anything rather than go in the trampoline.
Sure. Okay. So I want to try and think about those in terms of stratifying that a little bit. And we don't have to enumerate that, but it's mainly, like you've just described then, you started to, for want of a better term, profile certain categories within that. You've said older than 40, you've said had children. Is it something, something that I imagine is a problem that can happen across all ages and across all sort of profiles of people? Are there other subsets worth mentioning in terms of that then? So you've certainly said following had a baby, you've mentioned, and let's zoom in on that then. Is there a relevance of vaginal delivery versus C-section? What are the mechanisms that sort of predispose those women?
Vaginal delivery increases your risk of pelvic floor problems because of the risk of birth injury. So if anybody comes into clinic and they've had a forceps delivery, if they've had a very fast second stage, so they've had the labour stage, the pushing stage has been short, you know, less than 2 hours.
Right.
Or if they've had a very delayed second stage, then the risk increases, because if you think about what happens when the baby's in the birth canal, if it's a long labour, I said 2 hours, I meant 20 minutes. If it's longer than an hour, the pressure of the baby's head can pressure on the pudendal nerve, so they can land up with like a neurological lack for a period of time. A birth injury is just a big old tear. If anybody has a third or fourth degree tear, which means that the tear has extended into the sphincter, then they are going to have problems with their bowel control. High forceps is associated with injury like a levator ani avulsion, where the levator ani muscle, just like any sports injury, it pings off the bone. And there's an obstetrician in Australia, Dietz, who's done a lot of work looking at this, and he reckons that a third of women who have had a vaginal delivery have this lack to some extent or another. And I think he's probably right. We don't check for it. We don't say it's a 6-week check. Can we see if your abdominal muscles have come back together? Have you got a rectus diastasis? Have you got a sports injury from birth? Are you okay? It's just not something that's facilitated. The biggest risk, though, with having children for women isn't the birth, it's the pregnancy. So having a C-section doesn't have a protective element against continence problems later on. You're not going to have issues with the vaginal injury, but it's the weight of the pregnancy on the pelvic floors and the effect of the hormones on the pelvic floors that predispose some women to it. And then when you look at subsets of physical type, anybody that's hypermobile, so you know, if you're looking, doing an MSK assessment, if somebody is just in the upper bendy range, they're at more risk of prolapse.
Right, okay. And is that because of their soft tissue characteristics being more predisposed to lengthening, for want of a better term, stretching, extending? So on that then, I'm thinking about, I'm already picking off detail of questions I would want to zoom in on, or at least be asking in the subjective assessment. And I feel like I should be caring about birth weight, or how far into term that you know, what stage was that baby delivered at which weight, because of not just, and regardless of delivery type, but also just in terms of the carriage of that and the pregnancy and variables like that. Are there any other things that I've not just reeled off there that I should be zooming in on when asking those questions?
Yeah, bigger baby, longer pushing stage, mode of delivery, whether they were leaking in the before they had the baby. So right. Leaking in the last 6 weeks of pregnancy or the first 6 weeks of pregnancy are problematic, because there's work being done at Aberdeen University where they found that leaking in the first 6 weeks, it's a long-term study that they're doing, and they knew that if they didn't do anything with their pelvic floor, they would still be wetting themselves when the child started school at five. But as the study's going on, they now know that the woman will still be wetting herself when the child starts high school at 12. Right. So this is a condition that the World Health Organization said in 1996 was largely preventable. And we know that, you know, upwards of 80% of them should be able to manage with pelvic floor exercises. But it's not, there's not a vehicle to deliver that information to new mums. And there's a very very persuasive myth that, well, you're just a leaking new mum, it's normal. Yeah. It's not a good deal. Asking about those risk factors is, and like their history is very important. But it's also, it won't catch everybody, because if your granny had women's troubles, you probably will as well, because of the genetic element that runs in families.
Right. So that was one of the things I was going to ask after, is that, you know, is there where are the genetic or other predisposing factors? Are there any activity-based predisposing factors worth mentioning? Yeah.
Impact exercise is problematic for lots and lots of women. So we want people to exercise, obviously. It's good for everything, particularly in the postnatal period, because, you know, in my N of one study, being at home with a baby all day makes you go a bit mad. And if you're able to get out and have 20-minute run to yourself, it's really good for your well-being, and you're much better able to nurture an infant if you have just a bit of a break. And particularly with runners, you know, like when I did MSK and sports stuff, runners just want to run. So you can say, well, you know, I know that this is how you manage your mood, and this is really important activity to you, but you are wetting yourself when you do it, so it's too much for your pelvic floor. Why don't you go swimming instead? They just look at you like you're mad, because that's not an alternative, because they are a runner. So you have to balance the benefits and the risks to it. And there's a really excellent bit of work being done by Tom Goon and Gráinne Donnelly and Emma Brockwell that have got together, because they're all, you know, running and postnatal experts, and have come up with guidelines for returning to run for postnatal women, which is a work of genius, because it's simple things like, can they do a lunge, can they do a straight leg raise, have they got doming of their rectus diastasis when they do that, are they able to get tension, and it's like tick box checklist for, if you can do all of these things, you're safe to go back to running. I forgot what you asked me, actually, sorry, I'm rambling now.
No, it's all right. We're talking about just activity-based predispositions.
Yes. Uh-huh. So impact exercise is problematic. People who have jobs where they're standing for long periods of time, then that's often a way of asking them about prolapse symptoms, that they're fine at the beginning of the shift, but by the time they've been on their feet for 12 hours as a nurse or a waitress or whatever it is that they're doing, they start to get dragging symptoms, a dragging sensation or an ache. And often they just accept that they have pelvic pain. They just cope with it. They think that it's normal.
And I suppose that this, it comes up in a few of our shows, really, is this term normal, when what we mean in there is it's a suggestion that it's not pathological or problematic. But actually, when it comes to statistical normal, they've got a point, in a sense, that it becomes normal the more that people ignore it. It becomes then the average woman would be considering themselves the norm, because, but it should, it's in our terminology, it's been, to consider it normal is to unfairly dismiss it. And so it ends up being something that the course correction is going to need a lot more attention, because the more that myth proliferates, the more people are just going to shrug it off and actually just over accept that is the new condition in which they need to exist. And I don't want to bother people with it. And when they ask their friends say, oh yeah, you know, that's fine. Rather than it being another, you know, in other circumstances where asking a friendship group who go, no, that sounds weird. They'd then feel more comfortable visiting a health professional to discuss it. So it's such a there's a balance that needs to be tipped in the direction of awareness, isn't there?
With this, I would put it into sex ed in schools or personal health and social education, I think they're calling it, since back. It's changed in the last 30 years since I had sex ed. If we taught our young people what normal peeing, pooing and sexual function was, then they would know if they're only going to the toilet once every 8 days, that that is not necessarily, you know, a good thing. The fact that that's what everybody in the household does... And it's normal. So we have in you know, the course of a child's life, they're being potty trained by somebody who is doing what their mother has done and their mother has done before them, but it's perhaps not based on any fact and anything that's a positive message that we'll want people to understand. If you don't know what normal is, you can't recognize what abnormal is. And that's why in clinic I see people that are peeing every 20 minutes. And they think it's normal because they're worried about having an accident. So they go to the toilet all the time just in case, because their mother was worried about having an accident. So she encouraged them to go to the toilet all the time just in case. And they land up giving themselves a bladder dysfunction. But because that's how everybody in their family operates, it's to them it's normal. And it's clearly not, because you can't hold down a job. You can't go out on a bus. You can't do things that you want to do because you're so concerned with your bladder. So I think that I could, you know, cut waiting lists no end if people knew what they can reasonably expect from their genitals. Teach them it when they're young. And the carrot is that if you've got a good responsive pelvic floor, then your sexual function is improved. And young people, they're interested in that. They're going to pay attention. So... why not sell it to them through sex, because sex sells everything else, and they will hook on to that. And then when later on, when they have a kid, they know that leaking is common. It's not normal. They don't need to put up with it.
Yeah, sure.
At the moment, the guidelines are that a woman should have pelvic health education in her first antenatal class, which also annoys me, because you're assuming that she's going to go to an antenatal class, and there's many, many people that they're just not able to access that. And again, in my N of one study, when I was in my first antenatal class, I was only interested in how they're going to get this baby out. You know, the midwives are very clear that it's the wrong time to get women to engage in pelvic health education because of so many other more pressing concerns. I think that teaching it earlier in school, and then revisiting it as antenatal, and then again when they go to see the GP at any stage or the practice nurse for a smear, just ask them, is this a problem, and get an honest answer out of them.
Yeah, definitely. I don't want to miss the bit where we talk about types of continence issues and their distinguishing features, particularly for an MSK audience that otherwise... I can imagine, and I know I'm guilty of it falling under one big category when there are distinctions that are relevant. So what are the types of continence issues, and what sets them apart?
So the most common one is stress incontinence, the one where you wet yourself if you laugh or cough or sneeze or run. And that's because the intra-abdominal pressure pushing down on the bladder should be counteracted by enough force generated by the pelvic floor to support the neck of the bladder and stop them from leaking. So if you're not able to do that, you're going to leak. It's the one that people, you know, they joke about. And at the school, like, don't make me laugh, the tears are running down my legs. That's just a phrase that women will say to each other for a joke. You can get little plaques to put up in your wall to amuse yourself. It's exasperating. So stress incontinence is the one that says that physio is more effective than, or the evidence says that physio is more effective than medication or surgery for stress incontinence. And it's the one that responds brilliantly to pelvic floor exercises, usually within sort of 12 to 16 weeks. If they commit to doing their exercises 3 times a day, the majority of them will become dry if they do it. It is a challenge to do anything 3 times a day. But stress incontinence is a bit of a gateway disorder, because wetting yourself is so embarrassing that most people will change their behaviour so that that doesn't happen to them again. They stop exercising for a start. they start drinking less because they think that being a bit dehydrated will manage their bladder problem, and they go to the toilet more frequently than they need to. So frequency is peeing more than 8 times a day or once at night, and it happens because the capacity of the bladder has shrunk. Because if you don't, the bladder wall has a muscle in it, the detrusor muscle, and what should happen is that as the bladder fills with urine, and it's about 50% capacity, then you get your sympathetic, you get your, oh, what is the word? Like your bladder tells you that you need to go for a pee soon, and you should be able to wait between 2 and 4 hours between that first urge to pee and actually being bursting. So if you don't wait until the bladder is completely full, then the bladder capacity shrinks, because if you don't stretch a muscle, it becomes less flexible. So if you're going to the toilet more often, you're not able to hold between 350 and 500 mils of pee in your bladder. You're only able to hold 300 mils. Then your signal to pee will be when it's at 150 mils. So they go to the toilet more often because they get the signal more often. And it responds really well to behavioural management stuff. We give them different cues to try and resist the urge and get them doing a decent pelvic floor contraction, because that can help reduce the urge. And it's just simple behavioural management for a lot of them. There is medication that can help because it's unusual. There's a lot of anxiety associated with the threat of incontinence. It really changes people's behaviour. So it can become quite complex quite quickly, but if you've just got somebody that's simply anxious about wetting themselves, so they're going to the toilet more often, then conservative treatment can be really effective. And then there's urgency, which is you can't wait the 2 to 4 hours. And it's really commonly seen when you put the key in the door, and that's because of conditioning. So normally when somebody goes home, they go to the toilet first. So they get onto the doorstep and the bladder is conditioned to know it's about to perform, and it starts to get all excited and they lose control of their bladder when their key goes in the door. Now, it can become really problematic for some people, particularly older people, and there's medication that can help. There's Botox you can get to sort of reduce the activity of the bladder, which works really, really well and is really helpful for people with neurological disorders and things, you know, like MS. Most people have a bit of a mixed picture because it takes an average of 7 years for them to come for help. So usually they've become quite a complex pattern by the time they land up in clinic. Male incontinence tends to be different because it's almost exclusively, like looking at the numbers, associated with their prostate health. And if they've had surgery, they become incontinent overnight, which is really shocking to them, and should be expected, because with good pre-op care, then they should know that this is what's going to happen. But there's good evidence that if they get pre-op physio and post-op physio within the first 6 weeks, they get really good function back. They're also easy to treat, much easier than women, because they're upset about having to use pads and it's really distressing to become incontinent overnight, because women are used to dealing with mess, they're used to dealing with pads, and it's a much slower trajectory. So they, before they know it, like they've just been dealing with a situation, and then a number of years later they realise that their whole life is controlled by their bladder and bowel. So I mean, there's low, it's a bit like, you know, like back assessments. You can do a basic back assessment and triage into something that's appropriate, or you can land up with things that are really super complex. But for the majority of people, they fall into those categories.
No, that's really interesting. And then is there anything we haven't covered with regards to subjective assessment variables that we should be asking after? And then of the ones we've mentioned, how do they most inform our clinical reasoning?
If it's a female person, then whether they're menopausal or not is significant, because at menopause, with the loss of estrogen, then it affects all your soft tissues, and because some of the pelvic floor muscles attach onto ligaments and the ligaments change with age, then they can start to be symptomatic. And there's lots and lots of women who feel really smug because they've had kids and they don't have any symptoms, and they become 51 years old and then suddenly their bladder function is gobbed, and they are devastated by it. So are they menopausal? And if they are they taking hormone replacement therapy? Are they getting some sort of estrogen replacement? Because often that in itself can change their symptoms that they get, particularly if they have like vaginal atrophy symptoms because of loss of estrogen, then you can get land up with a really horrible, very itchy and irritated vulva that's more prone to getting urinary tract infections, because it's not just the tissue of the vulva that's affected, it's all of it. So it's including the tissue around about the urethra. So if they get a lot of urinary tract infections, is that part of it? Because the other thing with that is it could be symptomatic of having an inefficient bladder. So when you pee, instead of it emptying fully, you've got bladder retention, which isn't uncommon. Right. And then you've got stale urine sitting there that is a link to getting urinary tract infections. I think the only other thing is rectus diastasis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we've mentioned that if a woman's pregnant and there's a gap between, you know, the linea alba, then that increases her risk of prolapse and back pain by about a third postnatally. And what we should be doing is checking to see if they've got return to function. Well, it's not even the muscles coming together. It's kind of they create tension, or do they get doming of their rectus? So that needs to be established as a risk factor, and obviously multiple pregnancies, more than one pregnancy close together in age, and being hyperflexible are risk factors for that. Some women just have amazing rectus diastasis for no discernible reason. We don't know why some people get it and some people don't, but we know that it is a risk for these things.
So in terms of teasing this information out, how do we approach asking the questions appropriately and sensitively? And is the biological sex of the therapist relevant to that? I admit to holding perhaps some more anxiety on my part than some of my female colleagues do visiting this, and especially some of my female colleagues that have had children or even encountered some of these problems feel that they've admitted to me that they felt increasingly more comfortable and have helped me with this question. I've asked plenty of them and continue to ask again. So what's your sort of take on that? How do we approach it sensibly?
Yeah, it's incredibly challenging because people lie. You know, it's an unusual person that says yes to the question, do you poop yourself? That's not the sort of information that people are inclined to divulge, particularly if you're thinking about it in an MSK setting. If there's only a curtain between you and who's next door, sure, and everybody can hear you, that they just, there's lots of evidence about this. Mm. That's why conscience physios have a door that we can shut,
yeah,
because it means that people are far more likely to open up. And even with that, there's pretty good anecdata that it takes a while to build up a therapeutic relationship with somebody so that they're honest with you. Usually sort of like after three sessions, if you've not heard by that point that this is affecting them in their intimate relationship, so they've got a sexual dysfunction, you probably don't have that. That it takes time for people to open up because it is so humiliating. I wrote a doctor I have an embarrassing problem sheet for some GPs that I was doing some work for, that so there's a male version and a female version, and it's I have a problem with my in the circle the bits. It's just a subjective history about genitals and bladder and bowel dysfunction, and the GPs were putting it in the waiting list, sorry, in the waiting room, so that people could take it silently and just slide it across the table, because it's a barrier to help seeking. Just asking somebody this question that makes them feel so vulnerable, because there's something really visceral about our need to be clean and dry. And if you don't have that, then you become anxious, because when you were a kid, somebody wet themselves in the classroom and everybody pointed and laughed. And the people that experience these problems are super sensitive to being mocked or humiliated. So if they don't know who can hear what you're, like what their answer is going to be, because they're in a gym or they've just got curtains behind it, the chances of them being honest is very low, and it's definitely a challenge. The thing that helps therapists ask the questions are knowing what to do with information that you get and knowing where to refer them on to. So there's been some work in Holland looking at urology nurses. So they are dealing with people with sexual dysfunctions because they're dealing with people with prostate problems. And even them in Holland wouldn't ask this question for fear of opening up a can of worms. So, you know, Holland's a pretty liberal society. Yeah. Working with that patient group, and even they find it difficult. So I'm increasingly moving towards using a checklist subjective assessment, because it takes the shock out of it as well. People are startled when you ask this question because it's a thing that they disguise and they worry about being discovered. Most of them are very concerned about odour control, and I see a lot of vulvas that have been scrubbed like potatoes because they're so worried. They land up with horrendous vulval dermatitis because goodness knows what they're putting in themselves. So yeah, this is a long rambling answer of it is really difficult. You need to think about your environment, and is that a barrier to them answering honestly? You have a very good point about gender and even age differences. So if your doctor is a person that's 20 years younger than you, are you going to tell them that you've got a sexual dysfunction? Or if they're 20 years older than you, if they're from a different cultural background, that these are all very well established barriers. So knowing your stuff so that you're able to be factual and frank and not embarrassed is key. Sure. And accepting that sometimes it takes a while for somebody to have confidence to share this information with you.
Mm. What's interesting about that is that I expected your, especially because of the nature of how you present material in such a varied way, but it's also a, you know, your art is your, as a comedian, is through linguistics. I expected you to perhaps have a few angles there you were to suggest, you know, here's a sleight of hand, but actually you've found that over time you've reverted back to, say, subtle written form, checklist based. You know, that has surprised me to some extent, but I can, your reasoning for why it makes total sense. It's a more subtle and an appropriate way of doing it.
We were talking before we were recording about how therapists, some people are very, very good at morphing their approach with patients. So if, like, anybody that's skilled and works in this field is good at reading people, so you know whether being jocular is appropriate or whether being very businesslike is appropriate with each individual. I would like to say that there's a definite recipe, but no, you have to read each patient and try and work out how to phrase it well. I can give you stock phrases like, you know, what women tend to do, particularly women, females that have had children, will say, this was what happened to me, it's very common, have you had that experience? And that helps female patients open up to female therapists. Or just say, this is a thing that happens commonly when you're menopausal. It increases in this population. Have you had experience of it? What I'm embarrassed about is when I worked in MSK, I would say, do you have any problems with your bowel or bladder? And the patient would say, what do you mean? And I would describe, you know, codequina risk. And they would say, no, I don't get that. So I would tick the boxes, no red flags. When actually, when they're asking you, what do you mean? They're asking for clarification because they're the person that, when they put the key in the door, they wet themselves.
Yeah, there's something underneath that. The fact that they're wanting a bit more information is telling, because otherwise they would have just replied to the negative. So, no, it's a great point, and we'll definitely come to some of the specifics on the red flag stuff. I think there's definite gaps there, and I've realised now it was before we pressed record, wasn't it, that we were talking about some of our experiences in that space, so we'll definitely double back on it. For the average MSK clinician, what advice can we give? Or should we refer to specialists early and sort of avoid weighing into those issues?
And there's a bit of debate. My opinion is everybody should ask, whether they're an MSK clinician, whether they're a respiratory specialist, whether they work in cardiac rehab or psychiatry, anybody that's dealing with people, because this problem is so common, you might be the person that they're honest with, and you can direct them to treatment that will change their lives. the guidelines are that if you're going to teach pelvic floor exercises, you have to do an internal, because there's some really good evidence that about 30% of people bear down instead of pulling up when they do their pelvic floor exercises. Now, that's totally valid. You can't argue with that. But from a practical point of view, there's 10 million pishy women in the country, and, you know, I'm good, but I'm not that good. So we need to have every patient encounter creating an opportunity to extract this information out of them. So I would like to see MSK assessments have this in as standard, with clinicians that then have the information about how to give them basic education, basic advice about simple things like reducing your caffeine. And sometimes you meet people that are only incontinent at weekends, and they come in really confused about it, but it's a significant problem, and it's alcohol related. If just alcohol is a real bladder irritant for that particular person. Yeah. And when you explain that to them, then they're dry. Sometimes it's simple things that can make, you know, be curative for their symptoms. With the subclinical people, I'm not talking about the complex ones that come into clinic.
Sure.
I think that's where the conflict comes, that yes, if you've got somebody that's had this problem for years and they're very vulnerable, they're very upset, and there's lots of physical issues as well as psychological and behavioural issues and myths that people believe, then yeah, that's a difficult project for somebody that doesn't specialise in the field. But for the basic subclinical people, then why could somebody that is a fitness professional not be able to triage them and signpost them? I don't think it's reasonable to say you need to be a specialist to deal with all of these.
So the triage and signposting thing, I feel, is a more comfortable threshold that can be reached by some of the answers and how to interpret the answers to the questions that we've managed to ask. But I'm someone who's enough. I'm au fait enough with your work to know that you've got your somewhat playful mantras and sort of you talk through reps and sets and squeeze and hold, etc., which I think it'd be good for us to recount in a second. But I think there are some people in that subclinical category. Let's say a patient of mine that comes in with what's described, you know, a hip impingement, for want of a better term, that's then that then is on questioning, also has these continence issues. We're seeing a lot of people doing higher level weights overhead, sort of into a low squat, into a snatch, lifting heavy weights and having continence issues as a secondary. But they're coming to me with this sore hip. They've then uncovered this. They're a bit reluctant for me to then make that referral or really act on the signposting. But I feel like I'm a bit torn as to whether or not to point them in the direction of, say, your resources, or talk through some of the tips and tricks we'll talk about in a second, as to, you know, try these things, in case I was to, if in case they were part of the 30% that bear down inappropriately. So I've got this sort of cost-benefit analysis between the fact that I'm fearful that they're just not going to act on this.
Yeah.
In case someone tells them to not CrossFit. But then also that if I were to therefore do an intervention that I think will resonate with them, that feels like they could integrate it into their rehab and perceive it to be appropriate with someone that they're otherwise trusting with their other issues, I might be seeing them fairly frequently for whatever reason. I'm so challenged by that, because I wouldn't want to do harm because I was just being a bit plucky. That's where I err on the side of caution. So I wonder if you could advise on that balance. Yeah.
And I've certainly had some very direct feedback about, you shouldn't be teaching everybody pelvic floor exercises, because if they've got a pelvic floor dysfunction, then it's that the muscle's not able to relax properly, so that then it can, you know, if it's always working at max, it gets tired, you're going to get symptoms from that. And that's true. But the thing about pelvic floor exercises is they won't work for those people, and there isn't a sell-by date for this. So are you doing any harm by, if given that the average length of time for somebody to come and seek help is 7 years, then I think that it's reasonable to give them something to try on their own. And if that doesn't work within 12 weeks, come back to clinic, because it might be that those are never going to work for you and you need to do something else. We would need to do a proper assessment. That given the numbers of people that there are out there, a significant percentage of them. Say, like in clinic, I reckon that about 30% of the women that I see, I only see once. So do they need to come? You know, is it just that they needed decent information and then they're able to go and manage themselves?
Sure.
So for that, those people, give them the basic information. If it doesn't work, then the chances are they're not doing the pelvic floor contraction properly, or they're not able, they're so weak they can't initiate it, or it's a dysfunction, it's not able to relax. So then they come back and address it then. Because the evidence says, you know, if a woman starts leaking when she's 6 weeks postnatal or within that period, sometimes it takes 5 to 10 years and beyond. My oldest patient was 84, yeah, and she'd been leaking for 50 years. She did fine because it was just changing the amount of tea that she drank, and she had a simple pelvic floor weakness that she did great. So yeah, it's not quite the same as, you know, like an acute inflammatory pattern where you've got a window of opportunity to change it. So I'm a bit more relaxed, and I know that I annoy people by saying that, but if you think about it as a long-term, lifelong condition, give them 3 months. If it doesn't work, follow them up.
That's where, again, from observation of yours and others' materials, I feel like I'm leaning towards, and I like that rationale and that logic. And I've an analogy that I used when you said it annoys people, and I've therefore, even though I'm the messenger, I've certainly annoyed people even reiterating that argument. I've then had some success with the analogy that if you were to stand in front of a room full of people and advocate for exercise or a couch for 5K, I'd still feel that the two people out of the 200 that might be in there that then have the get up and go to think, yeah, I'm going to act on that, but then happen to have had an undiagnosed heart condition that then does, you know, if you'd have known on a one-on-one basis and been able to tease out very detailed variables, you might not have advocated for them to do that, and they'd have had a checkup beforehand. The net benefit of that intervention, although it's got its issues for those two out of the 200, and I'm getting my stats a bit mixed up there, aren't I? But as a general rule, I'd still feel quite comfortable ethically to have made that intervention. And that has, I've found that that's changed a couple of people's minds on that. Not all, unfortunately. Some people are in the trenches, and there's this sense of specialism that they want to retain, which is often the key variable. But do you feel that logic plays, and do you find yourself agreeing with that generally theme?
Yeah, and I have, you know, like the specialists that work in this area that disagree, I totally see their point of view, but the people that I'm talking to publicly, so if you're in, like you're saying, if you're in with the general population and you're giving this information, they're not the same as the very complex person that you're dealing with one-to-one in clinic.
Sure.
But there is an opportunity to create, you know, a therapeutic opportunity to do an intervention, and it's just educating them, try this, if it doesn't work, do come to clinic and we'll do a one-to-one assessment. They're not changing their situation. You're not going to put them at risk of, for instance, having a cardiac event. The worst thing that's going to happen is they're going to wet themselves or poo themselves, and they're doing that anyway.
The consequences aren't severe, but the gains on mass are quite significant, as you've said.
If you can tell them 12 weeks, if this doesn't change in 12 weeks, come to clinic, then they're still coming more quickly than they would do normally, because it takes 10, 12 years for those symptoms.
Without you having had such a deleterious effect by poor advice that therefore it becomes a bigger mountain to climb. Whereas in other circumstances, it is more drastic. Even in the example I gave, you know, the consequences are far more drastic. But even then, I'm still using that argument as a means of saying that's still an ethically positive intervention. So would this be an appropriate time for you to perhaps, I'm not saying you have to get into character, I know that Gussie Grips isn't a literal character you play, but I just wondered if perhaps you could give the listeners a clue, if they haven't seen it before, as to what your mantra would be. Mantra is not the right term, but I think you know what I'm meaning. Pardon?
Nonsense.
Yeah, well, if you can give us a clue as to what you might have your audience do, or even a TV audience, I've seen you do it.
Yeah. So the evidence is that you need to do one long contraction for a count of 10 of your pelvic floor, and then 10 quick flicks 3 times a day for 3 to 4 months. So to do a good pelvic floor contraction, which is really challenging for lots and lots of people, but there's been work done, ultrasound in tummies and shouting at, giving commands to patients. So cues that work are things like, imagine that you have a zip fitted going from the back passage all the way around to the front, and you're going to zip it forwards. Lift your testicles to your spectacles works really well. This is Kate Crotty's work. And I love that because it works even if you don't have testicles.
Or spectacles.
Good point. And the one that worked the best was, imagine you're holding in a fart, because the action of your pelvic floor is to squeeze and lift, and that's what you do. If you think about it, that's what your bum hole is doing when you're trying to hold in a fart. So I set the scene of, imagine you're on a date with somebody that you really fancy, but you can feel a fart brewing and you know that it's going to be horrendous because you know what you ate yesterday. You're not going to let that out. You're going to squeeze and lift your bum hole tight shut and hold it for a count of 10 seconds. And it has to be 10 seconds because there's a reflex inhibition of the urge to pee at 10 seconds. So if you're too weak to initiate a contraction for that long, then you don't get the benefit of the reduction of urge. So then you worry because you feel like you have no control. So 10 seconds is a goal. It's not always possible. A lot of people can do a contraction that just gradually fades off and they're not even aware that they've let go because the sensation isn't great up there. Sure. There's lots of sensation around about, you know, bum holes, but the rest of the actual pelvic floor, often they're very disengaged. Sure. So you do hold for a count of 10, but the important thing is you have to keep breathing at the same time. Because pelvic floors aren't fixed, because as your diaphragm rises and falls, it goes with it. So if you hold your breath when you do a pelvic floor contraction, it's less efficient because your pelvic floor then isn't moving normally. And that's a symptom of pelvic floor dysfunction, where it's just not able to relax and becomes less efficient because of that. It's always working maximally. So hold for a count of 10, keep breathing at the same time, and the sensation is right underneath. If they're feeling it in their butt or in their thighs, they're cheating. They need to be able to feel it right underneath. Sure. And I use it on stage. I have a really horrible analogy that makes me deeply uncomfortable. But if you imagine you're trying to make enough space between you and your pants to put a folded £50 note in, that works as a cue, but it goes against all of my feminist principles. But I use it anyway.
Yeah, until you find a replacement, and it's going to have to be one that you use.
Hold for a count of 10, and then you need to do 10 quick flicks in a row. So like, oh, I'm going to fart. Oh, it's okay, I've gone away, because that will help if you laugh or cough or sneeze. That will help with the dysfunction thing. So hold for a count of 10, 10 quick flicks, 3 times a day. We won't pee with a 10, 10, 3. So they do that 3 times a day, every day until they're dry, and then once a day, every day until they die.
Brilliant. I like that. Can me, you and the thousands of listeners do that together now then? So let's give that a whirl. We'll use the fart examples. It's certainly my favourite of your cues, although the £50 note one obviously tickles me too. But using the fart one then, if you can coach us all, me and the thousands, through this, that'd be mega. Let's get it done.
So take a deep breath in and then sigh out, and then squeeze and lift your bum hole. So you're holding in a fart, and hold it for 10, 9, 8, 7, keep squeezing. 4, 3, 2, 1, and then relax. That's very impressive. Your eyebrows didn't move or anything like that.
Yeah, I bet everyone's pleased that we've not got cameras on their cars, etc. now, are we? Yeah, okay.
And then they would do the 10 quick flicks. So it's like, so you're going to squeeze and lift and then relax.
Okay.
So squeeze and lift and relax. Oh, I'm going to fart. Oh, it's all right, it's going away. Oh, that's going to be terrible. It's all right, it's going away. And you do 10 in a row at that kind of speed.
Yeah.
Now, I can see you bobbing up and down in your chair a bit, so I think you're probably gripping your butt.
I'm over-clenching there, aren't I? Yeah. Yeah. Now my eyebrows are raising. Yeah.
I don't know why that is. I can't find an anatomical link between eyebrows and pelvic floor, as far as I can tell.
Well, for me, you're fortunate that we're on Skype, but I did actually need to fart. So that's why it's terrible in here. My eyebrows are raising for totally different reasons. So I wish we'd have had that lesson half an hour ago. It stinks in here. So no, thank you for that. That's really useful and certainly one that answers that question a little bit as to is there an early intervention that can be used as a means of sort of stratifying that, as long as it's accompanied with the fact that if this doesn't move your dysfunction in the right direction, then please do seek help. And you've almost triaged it in that sense. And also, like you said, this isn't necessarily for the complex category, in which it's quite more obvious from the answers to the questions that this needs a referral as a matter of immediacy. These are for these MSK patients that also have that as an aside. They're not taking it as seriously as we'd like them to, but similarly, we're not wanting to immediately pathologize that or to clog up waiting lists that we know, unfortunately, there's a thinness on the ground of specialists in this region. So as generalists, we should be upskilling in that direction, but also knowing our limits. So it seems that we've managed to navigate that fairly sensibly, I think, today. So that's, I'm really, really pleased with that. In terms of managing expectations, what level of improvement and in what time frame can we expect then? If we were to do that or something similar as an intervention with the appropriate advice that accompanies it, what should we be telling them? Is that the 12-week threshold as you've mentioned, or is there others?
Yeah, it's really slow. It's 16 weeks is the sort of time frame that you would expect to see an improvement within. We can see patients for a year quite easily, but you see them less often. So you're seeing them, giving them something to go and work on for a number of weeks, because the pelvic floor's got a lot of gristle in it. Like, it doesn't behave in the same way as other muscles. There's three layers of muscle that all share the same nerve and all have pretty much the same action. So it takes time to be able to teach the patient how to do exercises if they're very, very weak, if they're very uncoordinated, or if they've got, you know, like an avulsion where the muscle pinged off during birth, vaginal delivery. And it responds incredibly slowly, which is frustrating. And it's hard to motivate people if you're only seeing them monthly and saying, go and do this for a month, and expect them to do something three times a day. So it is reasonable to say to them, this is not going to change overnight. You need to actually make a commitment. If you're trying to get them to change their habits, so instead of first feeling the urge to pee and rush into the toilet, we want you to wait and defer for 10 seconds, 30 seconds, up to a minute. A lot of specialists will see somebody do an assessment, review them in a week or two, and then do a phone assessment in a week and just do motivation and encouragement. And there's all sorts of different ways around it, but it is very slow.
Right, okay. No, that's useful to know, especially because we don't want to be giving out false expectations on that, or try this for a few days.
Yeah.
That'd be clumsy and counterproductive. Even if it was the right advice with the wrong time frames, and we know that would dishearten folk, wouldn't it? So that's smart. To double back on the red flags thing then, so they often, you know, in MSK, the reason we're asking about bladder and bowels is all too often purely as a means of triage for Cordyceps syndrome or other loss of neurological function to the genital and pelvic organs. Mm-hmm. And so we've all kind of navigated this, and we had a podcast on it recently as well, where we're trying to navigate how to ask those questions sensibly and appropriately. But also, I wondered if the questions that we now ask might be different to the way that you would ask them or suggest that we ask them, in order to tease out the variables and distinction between neurological loss of function, as I'm describing, through something like corda equina, and a less urgent control issue, which, whilst we're saying is serious, as we've said through this podcast, it doesn't necessarily mean take yourself to A&E now for an MR. There is a distinction worth making there. So I wondered, what are the key factors of how to tease those things out, do you feel, in your questioning?
Well, the other neurological symptoms of tingling, numbness and things like that are obviously critical to be able to pick up. People can have frank bladder loss with bladder dysfunctions, like you would do with something that's really concerning, but it's very, very unusual. And often it's the timing of it is predictable. So the person knows that it's if the bus is stuck in traffic, and they know the time frame that they can go to the toilet in safely. Whereas if it's a red flag, then it's unpredictable.
Sure.
And the volumes are massive rather than it just being a wee bit. So I ask questions like, so if you're leaking, is it enough just to, like, what's the amount of it? Do you need to change your underwear? Do you need to change your clothes? Does anybody else know that it's happened? Because frank bladder loss is impossible to disguise. Postnatal women are more likely to, you know, if they've had a birth injury or if they've got swelling around stitches and things like that and their sensation is altered, then sometimes they can have a big frank loss, but that's explained by the life event that's just happened to them, right, rather than being inexplicable and a worry.
No, that makes sense. So the context surrounding it, as well as, like you say, volume of fluid, but also the, it's that mechanism, is it mechanical to non-mechanical, although yeah, crude terms, certainly plays here, doesn't it, where can it be reasonably rationalized as being, yeah, as being something other than an overt neurological loss.
And always bearing in mind that sometimes these symptoms are early indicators of a neurological issue. So don't assume that just because she's had a baby, then it's just simple postnatal leaking. You know, that would be incredibly unlucky, but it does happen.
Sure. No, of course. And it's interesting because some of the, although tough science, but some of the mechanical predispositions to dyspathology can sometimes be coincide with pregnancy and delivery, etc., and things like that, and therefore they can coexist, and we need to therefore tease these things out sensibly. But there's a few good angles, definitely. That's going to be massively helpful. The one thing I wanted to just touch on that doubles us back a little bit with regards to this societal take on this that might just help us to tie it all together is that, do you have and this speaks to not just this particular issue but also various ones in society at the moment, just the cultural zeitgeist that we have at the moment, and decreasing stigma around an issue and where the threshold is therefore to normalizing it, and that, because your work is about making sure. And you seem, to my mind, I mean, biased as hell, because that's one of the reasons why I'm a fan and I've had you on the show, is because I think you seem to get that so right, but I really struggle to know how you tread that line. You decrease stigma, but you also avoid that then teetering into normalization, as if to suggest that not only is it something that you still manage to make it not okay. You're not trying to suggest it's okay to do that. You still want people to seek help, but you're also appropriately empathetic and compassionate about the fact that that happens, that society at large shouldn't be laughing and tittering at bus stops if someone was to wet themselves. You know, we need that balance. You seem to get it right. Very few do. I wondered if that's thoughtful on your part, or whether you know it's just something that you've sort of landed on.
I think it's because it's evidence-based, because everything that I say I can back up from excellent data. And because I've got a clinical experience with this population who are intensely vulnerable to being mocked, and humour is subjective, but these people would not find it funny if they were the butt of the joke. It would just be bullying. It doesn't work. I think that talking is kryptonite for taboos. It's the only way to make it reasonable for people to communicate about these things and then give them the confidence and the language to be able to seek help. And if you make somebody laugh about something, you make them talk to their friend about it, so then they gain empathy with each other. And what I notice in the shows in particular is it's socially cohesive groups of women that come together, and you can see them nudging each other, saying, "That's you, she's talking about you, because I've seen you do that." So that sets up like an informal support network. Sure. And particularly women are very, very good at that, that they will nudge each other into help seeking. She said you should go to the doctor and you've not done it yet. When are you going to take action? The way that the pad manufacturers and to be honest, most of the manufacturers of any sort of equipment that help with this, they try to address the stigma by saying this is so common you really shouldn't be upset about it, which is ludicrous, because nobody is ever okay with wetting themselves or losing bowel control. There was a small study done in Canada that fascinated me, that was a palliative care nurse who asked people who were using the hospice but who weren't actively dying. They weren't inpatients, but they had a life-limiting condition. And he asked them, what is your step too far? Like, where is your line where you think life won't be worth living? And gave them things like, is it being tube fed? Is it having pain? Is it being ventilated? 78% of them said it was having poor bowel and bladder control in front of their family. That if they were incontinent, they would rather be dead.
Oh, my God.
So it's really massive, the impact that this has on people. And just to flippantly say, oh, it's an oops moment, oh, I won't let a bit of wee stop me being me, is outrageous, because you are reducing the you're not nudging people into help seeking, you're normalising it and saying it's common. It is common, but it's never normal, and you shouldn't have to put up with it.
Go on.
Because the secondary impacts of incontinence are underestimated and undervalued. The main one being it's a barrier to exercise. So if we have 1 in 6 premature deaths in the UK caused by diseases of inactivity, why are we allowing pad manufacturers to say, oh, you don't need to worry about this, you just need to buy a nappy, and it's all right because it's black and it's got some lace on it, so, you know, this isn't a problem. But actually, it is a problem, because the second biggest reason for a woman moving into residential care is incontinence. And how many of these women who are physically frail have just got an old birth injury that could have been treated?
And kept them independent for longer, which has, of course, huge social gains as well as personal gains.
And I'm embarrassed by addressing it. I mean, I'm quite hard to embarrass. It's a lack in my... My children are most annoyed about this. But it is common. So don't... Like, if it's more common to have incontinence than it is to have hay fever or athlete's foot, why should you be embarrassed? Because it's not something that you need to put up with. There's gold standard evidence to help you. Yeah. You just need to take your broken bits to somebody that can do that for you.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, whilst needing to be devil's advocate, because I agree with what you've said there, there is an argument that comes loosely from a body positivity angle as to suggest that if, you know, it's up to society to comply with this concept of some women leak, get over it. Therefore, to suggest that those women should or could seek help, it's like, well, why seek help? Realistically, it's something that, you know, live and let live. It's my choice to do so, and therefore it goes away from decreasing stigma and towards a concept of normalization. If I've encountered it and been put on my heels by it, even though far from a specialist in this area, I imagine you've encountered that line of argumentation, and I wonder what your take was on that.
Yeah, I do come across women, particularly online, not in clinic, because they're the ones that are help-seeking, so they're the ones that it's not acceptable for. But I get emails from people saying, I don't have a problem with this, it's just what happens when you're female, because the myths are so pervasive that people genuinely believe it. Perhaps there are some people that don't mind being incontinent, but that's not what the data says.
Sure.
So I don't actually believe them. I think that I'm not saying that they're lying. I'm saying that they are accepting of a situation, but I don't believe that they want to continue on living like that with the knowledge that it's going to get worse. So if you say to them, well, at the moment, it's only 5 mils is the average leak when you laugh or cough or sneeze. It's just a teaspoon. It's not a massive amount. But in 10 years' time, when you've also got a bladder dysfunction because you've started changing the way that you go to the toilet because you're worried because you have a big, massive leak in front of people and it's embarrassing, then you'll come and see me. And they all do. It's not acceptable to wet yourself. It's basic human dignity. It's part of basic care packages that we put into every avenue of nursing, that it's vital for your sense of well-being. The impact of incontinence on somebody's well-being is well documented as being greater than the impact of asthma, greater than the impact of diabetes. And when you get into older care, geriatric care, it's the biggest indicator of quality of life. So she's kidding herself on when she says, oh, I don't mind, it's just a wee bit. Well, you will. You will mind.
And the act of, let's say then it's someone that then argues that, again I've encountered, you're right, certainly more online than offline, that the act of it being something that women do care about is because of the patriarchal assumption that women need to comply within a narrow role, including not to leak in public. And therefore the act of even caring is something that is to try, and you're almost complying with the stereotypal needs to not leak. And therefore there's that angle to it. So it's not as if they're not recognising what you're describing, that a lot of people do care, but they're suggesting that those that do care are actually only caring because of that social expectation.
And in France is often held up as being, you know, the bastion of best practice, because the state funds, I think it's 10 sessions of postnatal physiotherapy for women. Right. The quality of what people get seems to be variable. Sometimes it's just like an electrical stimulation for a few weeks, and other times it's really good one-to-one intervention. But the reason that the state fund it would appear to be largely misogynistic in root, in that it's to try and get women back to being sexually active as quickly as possible.
Right.
So that's, like, you know, from a long-standing cultural approach. So I can see where the argument comes from, but I just dismiss it, because if you want women to be empowered and capable, they have to have body control, because this is a barrier to every single thing that she wants to do. It interferes with everything if she wants to wear. She will be considering, is it going to disguise a leak? Is it small enough to pack up into a bag so that I can take it with me for a change of clothes? Where am I going to dispose of things that are soiled? Where can I travel to? Because I can't be confident that I can make it to the next service station on the motorway or aeroplane travel. What do you do if they don't unfasten the seatbelt sign goes on? That is really terrifying for people. So I would argue the counter thing. If you want women to be controlled and limited and have less interesting lives than they're capable of, don't fix their fannies.
you've just reminded me of a real, as you mentioned earlier, it takes a lot to embarrass you, it takes a lot to embarrass me, even in this space. But there's a patient I was having these discussions with and stuff, and asked as to what are the sort of social circumstances in which you most struggle with this, and she said turbulence. And yeah. I then thought, this is the night, my naivety was then to think, wow, there's clearly a mechanical sensitivity sufficient that a turbulent plane would be stressful sufficiently for it to leak. And I then sort of reiterated that as best I could, and she just sort of laughed at me and just went, no, because then the seatbelt sign's on, you muppet, I can't get to the loo. It wasn't anything to do with the mechanism of turbulence, so I felt a right mug for that. But we had a laugh, and my red face cleared. But it's a great point, is that there's certain circumstances in which, when you're in less control of your ability to go to a toilet or it being in close proximity. And so, yeah, thank you for visiting that. That was it's really useful, because, as I said before, you do seem to toe that line really sensibly, and I wish more did it, because we do need to decrease stigma, but we also need to avoid that sense of normalization that means that fewer people get help, and in an area in which help is available. It's not as if they need to go on a 1% dream of it working. It's something that has great evidence base.
Yeah, it is just so very subtle. I mean, some of the campaigns that the PR companies come up for these big industrial, for these big commercial enterprises, they just kind of miss the mark. That it's very easy to get it wrong. And I think that I have, because I've got clinical experience, because I've got personal experience, and because I'm a bit like a dog with a bone with this issue and a little bit obsessive about it, I figured out what works and what doesn't quite well. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting watching things that are tried that just fall flat in their face and are never mentioned again, because they're not speaking to the right people. If you get a focus group of women and say, how do you feel about incontinence, then they'll give you the standard chat. But it's not until you actually drill down with seeing somebody whose life has been completely devastated, that her intimate relationship has dissolved because she's worried about wetting herself at the point of orgasm. So they stop having sex, and it impacts on their marriage in a way that ruins it. People get divorced because of these problems, and they're intensely vulnerable. So once people start to open up and tell you the problems, you get a much better understanding about the impact. And that's why you would, if you had any sense at all, you would never trivialise it with saying, oh, it's just an oops moment, because it's not. It's devastating. It's a terrible burden to have to counter into your day. And it's outrageous that you would use language like that for something. You wouldn't use it for anything else. You wouldn't say to somebody that had a stroke, oh, you're just a bit floppy on one side. Oh, it's just nonsense.
Floppy moment. Yeah, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't dare. No, exactly. It's a great point, and something we need to take appropriately seriously, and also just mobilise more of the workforce, more of the available workforce, upskilling. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, our listeners in this direction just helps to move the needle slightly in that direction. But thank you so much for all the work you're doing on this, because it really does give us an obvious roadmap to try and follow, compared to other things that sometimes feel a bit too daunting, too laced with jargon, too intimidating for us mere MSK professionals. And so you really are making that more accessible for us, and hopefully we can then help to continue your good work in that space. So where do people find more about you? And
My website's terrible. I need to get it sorted. I'm continually sorting my website. At the moment, it's www.gussetgrippers.co.uk, and it needs updating. And I have got a half-finished one with loads of really good content, but it's not up yet. Right. And on social media, I'm at Gussie Grips at Twitter. I'm not bad at Twitter. I'm quite good at finding nuggets of information on Twitter and retweeting them. They're all to do with bums and feminist rants. And I think I'm the same on Instagram, which I'm also rubbish with. And just message me, just email me.
Your Facebook's good. We'll definitely put the links to all your social media and your website and stuff like that. And there are a few clips on YouTube, certainly well worth people finding. So we'll link to those, as well as the referenced material that we've talked about today we've discussed. We'll definitely get that in the show notes newsletter for this episode.
So, there are some very good online resources that I'll give you. The Australians have got some brilliant stuff. There's the Sex Education Forum is very good, right. For places to signpost people to, because then they're getting specialist information and it'll just nudge them into coming back for the referral.
Right. No, brilliant. And if I imagine, is your Fringe show sold out? So we can't even plug tickets.
It's not sold out. Right, so we can, massive room.
Right. Well, I'm trying to think though. I wonder if it might be over before this podcast goes out. That's one of the dangers. But future shows, I suppose we can always mention. Would that be on your website as well?
Yeah, I'm gonna get it up on the website. Great. So that I'm gonna be more disciplined with all of that.
Fantastic. No, thank you so much for all that you do. And we've touched more on continence this time. There's plenty more on this topic that we could visit. And so hopefully we could get you back on the show in the future, because we've had a good time, haven't we? That's been fun.
Thank you for having me, Jack.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
Well, I think you'll agree with me. Lots to admire within that podcast. Elaine's achievements with her Edinburgh show and the way she gets broadcast across the mainstream media is something that many, many, many physios can learn from. We don't get enough of us onto the screens, and Elaine is an excellent example of what can happen when you do manage to do that, and how you can spread your message far and wide. I hope you've enjoyed this with us and this month's podcast. Please follow the team on @TPMPodcast. Follow Jack Chu @JackAChu. You can follow Elaine @GussieGrips, that's GUSSIE Grips. Check out her website as mentioned. We will have all the resources for you in the newsletter coming up imminently, and we will see you at the conference. Unsurprisingly, Jack forgot to record a sign out with Elaine, so you get me doing it this month. You've been listening to the Physio Matters podcast, discussing physio matters because physio matters. Bye for now.